You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 24th of June, 2018. It's the start of another week at Radio Aryan, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Of course, as it's Aryan Britannia, we're joined today by Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing on this fine, sunny afternoon?
It is. It's a lovely afternoon. I've just been out sunning myself on the local village green, and it's been absolutely blissful.
Yeah, it's been a really good weekend of weather, thankfully. It was good weather for the Brexit rally that was on Saturday, which I was quite very impressed with, actually, the speeches that were there. This rally that went on, it was a counter-protest to the Ramoners, who had thousands of people out, of course, because it's London. London is multicultural and it supported staying in the EU. So, of course, when they have a march in London to say they need to stop Brexit, it's going to have lots of people at it. But they still managed to have, I think, 3,000 people at the pro-Brexit march. And it had Gerard Batten from UKIP speaking there, Janice Atkinson from UKIP. They had Anne-Marie Waters from For Britain. They had some people, I think they were called the Red Pill Factory, who were very good at the end. They were bringing up the Coudenhove Kalergi plan, white genocide, the replacement of our people. They were very careful in the wording that they actually used. Instead of saying that the Coudenhove Kalergi plan was to change the ethnic makeup, they said that they wanted to change the country and turn it into North Africa so that it looked like North Africa. So they were quite careful with their wording. Janice Atkinson, she seems to be moving further to the right all the time. I mean, every one of the points that she raised would be in common with the sort of things that we'd be raising, talking about Islamization, talking about replacement levels of immigration, grooming gangs, the fact that we have waiting lists at the hospitals, waiting lists at schools, the fact that we need to be building on every bit of greenbelt land we have to cope with this invasion, whereas we're not producing enough children to replace ourselves. We shouldn't actually need any houses at all. So it was all in all like a really, really good rally, I thought, and lots and lots of chants of free Tommy Robinson. Oh, and they had a woman called Granny Robinson who had written a piece of poetry, which I thought was very good. Again, it was highlighting all these points. So for a showing from the alt-light or the soft right, whatever you want to call them, I think it was very good. Did you catch any of it, Max?
I only saw a little bit of it. I must admit that I wasn't aware that it was taking place and just caught a few of the later reports. I think it is very, very interesting that they did actually raise the Coudenhove Kalergi plan, because, of course, prior to perhaps 5 or perhaps 10 years ago, if it had come to light and if people had been speaking about the Coudenhove Kalergi plan and they'd been raising the fact that Coudenhove Kalergi advocates the race mixing of Europeans with people from North Africa in order to create a kind of mixed race type of population for Europe, most people probably wouldn't have believed that. They would have thought that was a bit sensationalist and perhaps scaremongering. But in the light of sort of greater discussion of the Coudenhove Kalergi plan, and in the light of recent years where thousands upon thousands of migrants have been pouring across the channel, where an entire sort of NGO industry has grown up, picking up people from little dinghies when they're just outside Libyan territorial waters and then ferrying them to Italy and Greece and to Spain. You know, in the light of all this, when it becomes obvious that there is a concerted effort on the part of lots of shady and conspiratorial groups to flood Europe with people from North Africa, of course, it's obvious to anybody, you know, anybody of average intelligence who reads the Coudenhove Clergy Plan and then looks at what's happening in the news can see either that the Coudenhove Clergy Plan is a plan that the European Union are working to, or, you know, somebody within Europe has discovered the Coudenhove Clergy Plan and sort of dusted it off, having not read it for quite a few years, and has suddenly decided, oh, that'd be quite a good thing to implement, wouldn't it? And has sort of cracked on with the invasion of Europe. And so what yesterday's rally suggests is that more and more people are waking up. And in fact, on the Western Spring website, I would say that we get more inquiries from people who have read the articles about the Coudenhove Clergy Plan on our website than every other article put together. So it is a powerful recruiting tool, and we need to talk it up and make sure that everybody knows that it isn't just accident. It's not just a fluke of fate that all these people happen to be ferried across the Mediterranean Sea by the navies and by the ships of all these NGOs that are doing this sort of thing. It is actually a concerted plan that people are following.
Well, that's what they were saying yesterday. They were saying, look, this isn't incompetence that you are seeing with the politicians. These are deliberate plans to replace us. They are deliberate plans to Islamize society. And they were pointing out the fact that the European Union was built to plans set out by Coudenhove Kalergi. I mean, they have the Coudenhove Kalergi Award. People like Angela Merkel, Tony Blair, George Bush even, they are given this award. And what is the award for? It's an award for implementing his plans. And his plan was to replace the white ethnic, white indigenous European population with a brown population through miscegenation. That was his direct plan. I believe it was Nick Griffin that actually brought this up on the floor of the European Parliament. It was possibly one of his best ever speeches. I mean, people still check that video today. People still link to it. And I think it's the first time that I've actually heard people that are aligned with UKIP actually talking about this, which does show that they are moving further to the right, which is really good. And I think it's also good that you're seeing people like For Britain and Anne-Marie Waters working alongside Gerard Batten. After she lost the leadership bid at UKIP, there could have been some bad feeling there. And they've clearly decided that, you know, it's far more important that we sort out the mess in Britain than, you know, have some kind of petty rivalry there. I mean, that is a good example to set, I think, Gerard Batten and For Britain, both on the same platform. They've also said that they will accept people from ex-members of the EDL. And of course, the UKIP constitution explicitly banned people from joining from the EDL or the BNP. So, I mean, we did think that UKIP was dead and gone, really, after all these leadership problems that they've had and after the failures that they've had at the elections. That, you know, maybe we spoke too soon. Maybe we are going to see, you know, a resurgence of interest in them. Their speeches were definitely grounded in reality, whereas the speeches from the other side were clearly not based in reality at all. I mean, they're living in a fantasy world. They were calling for another referendum, calling for us to stay in the EU, saying about how they've done away with the children's future and all of this nonsense. You know, it really does annoy me when I see young people of student age which are criticizing the people that voted to leave the EU. They're saying, oh, well, you'll all be dead and gone by the time we have to put up with it. And the fact of the matter is, these older people weren't voting for themselves. They weren't voting so that they're going to get higher pensions because we leave the EU. They voted to leave the EU because they wanted a better environment for their grandchildren. They wanted them to be able to have jobs. They weren't voting for themselves. They weren't being selfish brats like these students are that are attacking their elderly. I mean, I think it's quite disgusting the way the youngsters are attacking the elderly.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think it was this week that Airbus announced that if there was a no-deal Brexit, they would be relocating their plant from Britain to China. And industrialists are always bemoaning the fact that as a result of these Brexit negotiations that there is uncertainty, and that uncertainty is one of the worst things for industry, and that the inference all the time is that, oh, if only we hadn't voted to leave Europe, we wouldn't have all this uncertainty. But in reality, there was no need for all this uncertainty. What should have happened is that as soon as the referendum result was known, we should have given the European Union at the most 3 months' notice of our termination of our membership of the European Union, and that would have really focused their minds on negotiating a deal. It's obvious that Europe exports far more to us than we export to them, so they've got far more to lose than we have, and so therefore there is far greater pressure on them to reach an accommodation with us than there is the other way around. And of course, there was no legal need for us to give 2 years' notice of leaving the European Union. The what was it called? Article 51 of the European Act, it stated that a period of a maximum of 2 years should be used to negotiate a country's withdrawal, not that it had to be the minimum amount of time. And of course, had we left, there would have been absolute certainty, because everybody would have known that initially we would be trading with Europe on world trade world trade authority terms, and as I say, that the minds of the European leaders would have then been very, very sharply focused on negotiating or preferential deals with us, and those deals would have been forthcoming. So, you know, what we needed really was strong leadership from Theresa May. She should have acted swiftly once she became the Prime Minister. But instead, what's happened is that she's vacillated and she's wobbled and wibbled and flopped this way and flopped that way, trying to please everybody. And of course, what she's ended up doing is creating this sort of long catalogue of uncertainty, this long catalogue of wailing and whinging on the part of all the Remainers, and this long catalogue of wailing and whinging on the part of certain industrialists as well. And it's interesting that if Airbus wanted to have the advantage of their production plant being in the European Union, and that's their reason for taking their production plant out of Britain if we get a no deal Brexit, then what's the point of them relocating their plant in China? Because China's outside the European Union as well. And what that actually goes to show is that they've got no intention of keeping that plant here in Britain. They wanted to move it to somewhere in the third world, or somewhere where the labour costs are lower, so that they could make all the more profit. And they just thought that rather than admit that they were exporting jobs from Britain to China, that they would use Brexit as an excuse, as a kind of fig leaf to cover up their embarrassment.
Yeah, definitely just an excuse. I think everybody that did actually vote to leave the EU, they were all expecting us to be out the next day. They were expecting us to hand in our notice, as it were, the next day. And that obviously hasn't happened. They're just prevaricating, really, and trying to drag it out as long as possible. It was good that the people that were there at the rally, they were calling Theresa May Treason May as well, pointing out the fact that what she's engaged in is treason. What the people that were marching for the EU, again, they were engaged in treason. I mean, they've got the European Union flag that they were flying, which is a flag of a foreign occupier, that's occupying Britain, telling us that we've got to keep our borders open, that we've got to pay out all this money to them. They were mocking and ridiculing this bus that said we'd have all this money for the NHS. And now we've got Theresa May saying that we're going to have all this money for the NHS out of the Brexit dividend, when we're not having to pay all this money back. So there wasn't any deceit on the side of the people that were saying we wanted to leave the EU. It was all on the side of the people that were saying we want to stay. I do find it entertaining that possibly by the time that we are actually out of the EU, the EU may have changed direction completely. I mean, you've got Sebastian Kurz, the president of Austria, who is who wants to stop immigration. He's in the Freedom Party that the mainstream media calls a far-right party, and he's forming a coalition at the moment. He's got Seehofer from Germany, who looks like he may be taking Merkel down, because he's also against the immigration, and he's forming an alliance with him, with Viktor Orban. Sebastian Kurz is actually in Hungary at the moment, talking to Viktor Orban, and also representatives of the Visegrad countries. So he's talking to Poland, Czechoslovakia, I forget the other ones. Plus, he's already formed his alliance with Italy, who are now saying that they are not going to allow any boats to dock in their country. And they're looking at the way that Orban is dealing with this, and he's made a new law that it's illegal to transplant a alien population into Hungary, and he's made a law that NGOs, anyone that helps illegal immigrants into Hungary, will face a year in prison, which means all these NGOs are now banned in Hungary. The law itself is called the Stop Soros Law. So he's forming this coalition with a view to when Austria takes the presidency of the European Union, which is next month. So, you know, we could feasibly see the European Union actually changing in direction. And all these Ramonas that are saying, oh, we've got to stay in the EU, we've got to stay in the EU. The EU may well actually turn out with, a harder border policy than we actually end up with in Britain by that time. And then what will they be saying? You know, I do have high hopes for this, what's going to happen with Austria. They were also talking about free speech, of course, and there were lots of mentions of Tommy Robinson and him being jailed and how he needs to be freed. But you do have to wonder sometimes when they are talking about free speech, you know, are they including everyone in that? Because they do mention Tommy Robinson, they mention Count Dankula, but you have yet to hear them mention Jez Turner or any of these lads that have been accused of being members of National Action, or the young lads that have been jailed for putting stickers up that say white zone, which were just in response to stickers saying Sharia zone. And I noticed this week a really shocking story that I found out about on Friday night. A 79-year-old woman who has campaigned to be an MP is facing 7 years in jail for 4 blog posts that she made, where she was apparently praising Hitler. She likened Jews to termites. She said something about the migrant children being disabled, which of course they are. 50% of them are inbred. They have a massive disabled rate and still birth rate among the Pakistani population of Britain because they are all inbred. So this woman was speaking the truth. She was saying that she supported Adolf Hitler, and her name is Barbara Fielding Morris. She stood as an independent in Stoke-on-Trent in the June election last year, and she's been found guilty, and she defended herself in court. She didn't even have a solicitor there. She quite clearly thought, well, there's no way I can, you know, be found guilty of a crime here. All I'm doing is voicing my opinion, which is what anybody would think. You know, 99% of Great Britain would think that you are perfectly free to voice your opinion, no matter what it's about. Doesn't matter if it goes against the government. 99% of the people in Britain think we are free to do that. So she quite clearly thought that there's no way she's going to be found guilty. And the judge has found her guilty. And he said that you are facing a possible sentence of 7 years. So she's now said that she would like to speak to a solicitor. I mean, this poor woman, she said something very good when she was found guilty. She said, I don't mind if you have found me guilty, as I've done my best to save you from extinction. So this woman clearly knows what is going on. She's clearly doing her very best, and she's been treated abominably, I think, Max.
Yeah, by the sound of things, she comes from probably our parents' generation, the generation that fought during the Second World War and that thought they were fighting to uphold freedom of speech in this country. And it was a very common slogan when I was a child that sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And if children whinged about rude things or cruel things that other children had said to them, most parents would recite that saying back to them and tell them just to pull themselves together and get on with whatever they were doing and ignore the person who was annoying them. But nowadays, of course, with the snowflake generation, you only have to say something that's mildly offensive to somebody, and it's as, almost as if the sky has fallen in, you know, with the shock and the horror that people react with. But it's interesting that this lady, I mean, you don't have to agree with everything that this woman said, but you know, she should have the right to speak her mind. And I was actually pleasantly surprised that earlier on this week when I was reading up some of the proceedings of the Bank of England's One Bank flagship seminar, and I was very pleased to note that Billy Bragg was asked to speak to the Bank of England before, you know, anybody falls over with shock that somebody who was a self-confessed Marxist in the past should actually be asked to address the Bank of England. Billy Bragg was announcing in the speech that he made that he is now a changed person, that he's no longer a Marxist, but he's now a progressive. And one of the things in his speech that he mentioned was that the utmost importance of upholding the right of everyone to think, to speak, and to act as they wish. And so, you know, whereas in the past Billy Bragg used to support things like Rock Against Racism and used to very sort of proudly state that there should be no platform for right-wing organisations or the BNP or whatever, you know, here he is now making a speech in front of a very august audience in the Bank of England and repeating the need for everyone to uphold the rights of everyone else to think, to speak, and to act as they wish. And so I'm sure that Billy Bragg will want to extend his sympathies to this lady that's now been prosecuted and found guilty over the fact that you know, she has been denied the right that he thinks everyone should have.
Well, she actually used the Human Rights Act as a defence. She said that it's in the Human Rights Act that you have freedom of conscience, and we have freedom to you know, say how we feel. And she also pointed out that what she was saying was scientific. She quite clearly thought that she hadn't actually done anything wrong. And one of the things that the judge was saying to her was, history tells us that if people were to see your articles, they may act on them. And again, this brings to mind something else from childhood. You mentioned there about sticks and stones might break my bones, but words will never hurt me. There was also another one, which was, if you ever did anything wrong and you said, well, so-and-so told me to do it, you know, they would say, well, if so-and-so told you to jump off a cliff, would you do it? And basically saying you have to have responsibility for your own actions. You cannot say somebody told me to do this and that's why I did it. So surely the judge cannot use that as an excuse for banning somebody from saying something, that there might be somebody out there who isn't responsible for their own actions that will just do exactly what you say. Because what that is doing is taking away free will. It means that nobody has free will anymore. It means that we could use as an excuse in court. We could say, oh, I saw it on the television. I saw somebody doing it on the television. So that's why I went out and did it. And that would be a valid defense. If this is a valid prosecution to say that somebody might have carried out what you said there, I think what she was talking about was gas chambers. She was saying something about we need some technological innovations to the gas chambers so that you know, they're not as ineffective as last time. Maybe she was joking around with that. Maybe she wasn't a revisionist. Maybe she was a revisionist. I don't know enough about this case, but the fact is that these new interpretations of the laws and these new hate speech laws that we have, they actually do away with free will. It's saying that nobody has free will anymore. It's a huge risk, whatever we say, that people might just copy it and carry it out.
Yeah, I mean, another factor of human behavior is that if you see somebody pontificating and putting on all their airs and graces and behaving like a stuffed shirt, then the natural tendency is to want to poke fun at them a little bit, or to say something that you know is going to enrage them. It's part of the human character that's is quite strongly aligned with humour and Mickey taking, that sort of thing. And so and one of the features of recent times really is that what we have, as we've discussed in previous weeks, is we've got certain elements within the within organised jury in this country who have just got zero sense of humour whatsoever, who have got a kind of zero tolerance approach to anything that it's not even just mickey taking, but which just questions things that they believe and that they profess. And it was interesting that not only was Billy Bragg addressing the Bank of England One Bank flagship seminar, but we also had Baroness Julia Neuberger, who I'd like to call Baroness Julie Annoyberger because she annoys me so much. But she was interviewed at that particular seminar as well, and she used the seminar as a platform to slate the Labour Party. And of course, she was a peer that was appointed as a result of her service to the Liberal Democrats, so she's got no sort of loyalty to the Labour Party. But she was using her interview there as an opportunity to slate the Labour Party, and she was pointing out that she was advocating that Jews should en masse leave the Labour Party so that the Labour Party can't win future elections, and was saying that that's the way to deal with anti-Semitism, it's to deny the party that's alleged to be anti-Semitic the ability to win elections. And it was just interesting to me that in order to substantiate her claim that anti-Semitism is rife within the Labour Party, she again trotted out this old trope. I'll use that word because it's fitting here. This old trope about the mural that there was in the East End of London that was painted, which supposedly depicted around about half a dozen or so Jewish bankers sitting around a monopoly board that was piled high with money, and who were supposedly profiting from the work and the slavery of the common people. When in reality, if you look at, if you actually Google that particular mural, and you have a look at the pictures that come up on the internet, what you see sitting around this table is a collection of middle-aged men. You know, they're men with graying hair, with moustaches. Some of them are a bit balding. I think one of them's got a monocle. But other than that, they're all dressed fairly conventionally. They're just a collection of random middle-aged men. And yet Julia Neuberger suggests that these people were caricatured Jewish bankers, that they are illustrations that could have been taken directly from the pages of Der Stürmer, and that they depicted people with Jewish bankers with hooked noses. And you know, that's just all absolute rubbish. That's just either an invention of hers, or it's an invention of somebody else's that she has that she's taken on board without actually ever checking the facts. And you know, she wants to go back and just actually have a look at that mural and just realise that, you know, although the artist that actually painted the mural intended for the bankers that he showed sitting around the monopoly table, that he intended some of them to be Jewish bankers, he also mentions that he intended them also to be European bankers as well, white European bankers. And so there was no intention on his part to use that mural as something to promote anti-Semitism. It was a mural that was intended to promote anti-capitalism. And yet here we are, we have Julia Neuberger pretending that the mural is intended to promote anti-Semitism as a means of attacking the Labour Party. And it's that kind of thin-skinned sensitivity, that kind of stuffed shirt pomposity that the common people, and not just the common people, virtually anybody really, most people like to poke fun at people that are pompous, don't they? And so, you know, this lady who was, you mentioned earlier, who's been arrested for saying things, and you mentioned that she'd, you know, said some things which sounded as though she was probably saying them a bit tongue-in-cheek. You know, she probably thought that she had the freedom to say a few risque things that would poke fun at the people who had arrested her. And it you can understand how somebody might naturally do that without any real animosity on their part. And the those people who are behaving in such a thin-skinned and oversensitive way are actually creating a self-fulfilling prophecy by being so thin-skinned, by being so pompous about all the everything to do with their community. What they're doing is they're setting themselves up for people to poke a bit of fun at, basically, because that's just human nature.
I do wonder who it was that got this lady to be arrested. You know, it's bound to have been some Jewish group somewhere. I haven't actually heard whether how involved they were or who it was that was involved with it. It does make me wonder a bit there, Max. So this is a banking conference. You've got a banking conference, and so far you've got Billy Bragg on there, and he's talking about how he's no longer a Marxist, he's progressive, and he wants to support free speech. And then you've got this Baroness Neuberger on there, a very Jewish name, who is talking about the Labour Party anti-Semitism. What has any of that got to do with banking? I mean, what are these people doing addressing bankers? You know, I thought banks were supposed to be about money, not about free speech issues and protecting Jews. I mean, what was the point of it all? I bet they had some rabbis there as well. Did they have rabbis speaking as well?
I don't know. Well, Julia Neuberger is a rabbi.
Baroness
Rabbi
know. Neuberger,
and it was the sort of inquisitiveness that was stirred in me when I saw that Billy Bragg was speaking there. When I saw that Julia Neuberger was speaking there, I had exactly the same reaction you did. What on earth is the Bank of England doing hosting a seminar where they have people who've got nothing to do with banking, people who've probably never, you know, even worked in a bank? They've got these people there. Oh, actually, Billy Bragg did mention that he was a runner for a bank when he first left school. So, you know, he would have run up and down Threadneedle Street carrying envelopes. But, I mean, that's as close to being a banker as he probably ever got. And the but, you know, what are these people doing at a conference that's being run by the Bank of England? And it's not just, you know, a conference. You know, had it been the Bank of England's motley array of British windbags seminar, then you could have understood why people of that sort would have been invited to speak. But you know, in view of the fact that it was called the One Bank Flagship Seminar, you know, flagship, it would tend to suggest that it's the seminar that they are investing the most in this year, that they are most proud of, that they feel is most fundamental to their function. And yet here we are, you know, with people who, you know, are more at home on question time on the BBC than they would be actually speaking seriously about banking to the country's top bankers.
Well, the Bank of England, that's supposed to be apolitical. Yet here it is with two avowed leftists speaking to them. It just shows you that there is no real difference between the mainstream parties anymore. They're all progressive. I mean, the Bank of England, you would think, was going to be heavily Tory, but here they are with these leftists speaking, because they all go along with the same agenda. They all want to replace white people with black. They all went along with the hate crime laws, the anti-free speech laws. They all want open borders. There's no difference between them at all. They're all calling for special Windrush days, special Stephen Lawrence days. I mean, nobody speaks up against any of this when they start talking about it in Parliament. I mean, they're really pushing this Windrush meme at us at the moment, saying, is it Windrush week, is it, or Windrush month, or something that they've got going on at the moment, Max?
I think it was actually the 22nd of this month that was the 70th anniversary of the Windrush docking at Tilbury. And yeah, it's that they do just seem to be making a mass out of this this event, and they're trying to portray it as if these people from Windrush generation came here to Britain and effectively were responsible for completely rebuilding the country. And you know, anybody listening to the way these people prattle on would imagine that the entirety of Britain had been bombed flat, and that we, you know, that we were living in one just massive bomb site, and we needed people to pour in from the outside world to actually rebuild all of Britain, when in reality it was only localized areas in the centers of most of our large towns and cities in the south of England that actually got bombed. There were some bombings of other places in Britain, but it was primarily in the large towns and cities in the south of England. And one of the facts that I quoted in an article that I posted on Western Spring website earlier on this week is that it's a fact that a greater tonnage of munitions, of high explosive munitions and incendiary bombs, was dropped on Berlin alone in just the last 2 weeks of World War II than fell on the entirety of Britain during the entire Second World War. So that gives you an idea of how little, you know, I'm not trying to sort of belittle the Blitz, because the Blitz would have been terrifying for the people who had German bombs dropping on top of them. And I don't wish to belittle the people who became victims of the Blitz, but to try and create the impression that Britain was virtually bombed out of existence is just ridiculous, when in reality the amount of bombing of Britain was minuscule compared with the bombing of towns and cities in Germany, in Poland and in Russia during the Second World War. You know, they were far more damage done there. And it's laughable to suggest that we would need people from the Caribbean whose experience of building construction techniques in a cold, wet, temperate climate would be anywhere near competent. You know, people who've lived all their lives on a tropical island would have no knowledge of the kind of building techniques that would be needed in order to make a building, just put damp-proof courses and things of this sort in modern buildings. And the reality of the matter is that thousands upon thousands of Irish men fought for Britain during the Second World War. Not just Irishmen from the north of Ireland, but Irishmen from the south of Ireland also volunteered. You know, there were a considerable number of Irish regiments that fought during the Second World War. And at the end of the Second World War, a large number of these people had spent time in England and who'd met English women and had decided to settle down. Also, a large number of Irish builders who were experienced in building in a cold, wet, temperate climate were coming into Britain. And I can recall as a child in the early post-war period, there being a very large quantity of families of Irish builders who came to settle in my hometown of Luton, and there were hardly any West Indians at all. And if you go online and you Google Irish construction workers rebuilding post-war Britain, then a whole array of photographs pop up of showing Irishmen digging ditches with spades in their hands, or pulling steel girders into place, or lifting lumps of concrete, or whatever it happens to be. And you can find videos of Irishmen working. And in these videos, if you listen to the soundtrack, sometimes they mention that there were some West Indians involved in it as well, but you just don't see them. You know, that the pictorial evidence is that West Indians didn't work on building sites. It was the Irish that worked on the building sites. And if any ethnic group deserves the credit for rebuilding post-war Britain, it's the Irish, not the West Indians. And so all this twaddle about the Windrush generation saving Britain and rebuilding Britain is just absolute nonsense.
So they're just stealing the glory of the Irish, really. It's the same as when they shoehorn Negroes into our history and say that they built Hadrian's Wall, and the white people around in Roman times, they were just pickpockets. And the Romans themselves were mixed race, the Roman overseers were, and Hadrian's Wall was built by Negroes. So they're just carrying on the same lies that they are on the BBC drama programmes and children's cartoon programmes, and they're now doing it in the news and trying to make out that Britain would just be a pile of rubble if it wasn't for these Negroes coming over with this holy Windrush generation that they speak of in hushed tones. We mustn't upset the Windrush generation. And yet whenever they interview them on the television, a lot of the time, you know, they can hardly string a sentence together. Some of them still can't even speak English. I really don't know what jobs it was that they were doing, probably toilet attendants, maybe bus driving. But I mean, kids always wanted to be bus drivers. I can't see that there was a shortage of people wanting to drive buses. As far as building houses as well, surely if we've had a lot of people killed during the war, you know, we're not really going to need any new houses building. There's going to be enough.
Well, I mean, as far as the numbers are concerned, there were around about 4 million men who were demobilized at the end of the Second World War. And during the Second World War, about 400,000 British servicemen had been killed in the fighting, and about a similar number had been injured. And so if you think about the situation that existed actually during the war, those 4 million soldiers were away fighting. The ones that had been killed were unfortunately dead, and the ones that had been injured were in hospitals or whatever. And so Britain was coping without with almost 5 million men missing from the home front. And the reason why we were coping with those 5 million men missing was because lots and lots of women stepped up, and they went into the factories and they did the works that the men had previously done, and they maintained the war effort. They not only maintained the war effort, that they maintained the domestic output that was needed in terms of all the domestic things that people need to have manufactured. They did that, and they kept the war effort going as well. So then in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, we had those 4 million men coming back and being demobilized, which then meant that in early post-war Britain, we were at the most only 1 million men down on what had existed during the war, when we'd been maintaining the war effort in addition to maintaining normal industrial output. And when you consider that out of the remaining million that's missing, 400,000 of them were dead and were never going to come back. But of the others, 400,000 or so of them had been injured, and so therefore would make some kind of a recovery. Many of them might have been disabled, but they would still be able to function and do work. And so the manpower situation in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War was massively better than the manpower situation had been actually during the war years. And there was no reason why all those women that had stepped up and gone into the factories, there's no reason why they should have been driven out of the factories and been sent back to their kitchens. That's a very kind of antiquated idea.